Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we ask, what is the relevance of Warren Buffett now? As the renowned investor prepares for another annual shareholder shindig in Omaha, can his famous investing philosophy still thrive in 2019? And then a look at Japan, which enters a new imperial era this week. The long-term challenges to its economy are well known, and its attempts to overcome them could hold clues for how the rest of the world faces up to aging populations and prolonged periods of low growth. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. There are famous investors, and then there is Warren Buffett. The 88-year-old Nebraskan is not so much followed as worshipped by a particular brand of investor, and thousands of those will gather this coming weekend for the annual shareholder meeting of Berkshire Hathaway. That's the conglomerate established by Buffett to put his investing wisdom into practice. But how relevant is that wisdom for ordinary investors in 2019? I'm joined by Fidelity Investment Director Tom Stevenson to try to answer that question. Tom, there's always lots of coverage about the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. It's a good excuse for journalists to replay all those Buffett quotes that investors love so much. But this time, the coverage has included the snippet that Buffett's own conglomerate, his company, Berkshire Hathaway, has underperformed the market in terms of performance. That's been a feature, hasn't it, of the coverage this time?
Yes, that's right. And this is a bit unusual, as you intimate. You know, when people talk about Buffett, they tend to talk in adulatory terms about his long-term outperformance of the market. And it's true. And I think it's important actually to put these recent comments about underperformance in context, because one of the great features of Warren Buffett's annual letter to shareholders is this wonderful table at the start, which shows the performance of Berkshire Hathaway shares since the company, since he started the investment company way back in 1965. You know, he doesn't hide anything. He shows the performance every single year since then, and he also shows the cumulative performance, and it is absolutely staggering what the long-term outperformance is. And it's a brilliant illustration, of course, of the power of compounding, because what he's managed to do with Berkshire Hathaway is grow the value of the shares in the company by a little over 20% a year. And he's done that for, I can't even work out how many years is it since 1965? It's 54 years. So you grow something at 20% a year for 54 years, you end up with a pretty massive number. In this case, it's 2.5 million percent.
Decent.
Yeah, it's a decent performance, and it compares with the S&P 500's 15,000% over the same period. So 15,000, 2.5 million, he's performed fantastically. But you're absolutely right, over the last 10 years, he has underperformed. So a dollar invested in Berkshire Hathaway 10 years ago would now be worth $2.40. If you'd invested the same dollar just by putting it in a tracker fund, an S&P 500 tracker, it would be worth $3.20.
Yeah, and by the way, I will say that I was being deliberately provocative here. Clearly, I don't want Warren Buffett's army of fans hounding me on social media or anything like that. That figure that you quote there about the underperformance, that's a 10-year period. Actually, if you'd gone back to a slightly longer period from the start of the financial crisis rather than the end of it, he would have outperformed. And also, a really important point that I want to raise here is that there's been no greater advocate of passive investing in the market as a whole through tracker funds than Warren Buffett, and it's a sort of curious paradox with the sort of phenomenon of Buffett that he himself tells everybody else not to do what he's done.
Yes, I think it came about when he was describing how he would advise his wife, I think, to invest her money after he shakes off this mortal coil, which at the age of 88, you know, is going to happen at some point, obviously. And I think he did say, you know, that she should just put her money in a tracker fund.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that has happened ahead of this meeting is that Buffett's given this interview to the Financial Times, and it's really revealing, as always, the interviews with him are, but it does quite a good job, I think, of analysing exactly why the Berkshire Hathaway in 2019 is perhaps a very different beast from what people maybe have in their mind when they think of Warren Buffett, which is for long periods in the 20th century of buying undervalued companies, seeing them grow exponentially. Berkshire Hathaway now is a very different thing, not least because of its size, which is absolutely vast.
Yes, and I think that's always a problem with any investor. You know, that their funds can simply get too big. I mean, if you bring it over to this side of the pond, we've seen a similar effect with Neil Woodford, for example. I mean, yeah. He ended up managing a massive fund and found it progressively difficult to make the kinds of investments that would move the dial on the portfolio as a whole. And clearly, that is even more of a problem with Buffett, because Berkshire Hathaway is now, I think, a $700 billion investment company, and it's throwing off, I think I read in the interview, $100 million a day in dividend income and other income. I mean, that's an impossibly large amount of money to know what to do with, and there just simply aren't that many companies in the world that he can invest in or buy that will make any difference at all to the overall performance.
I think that's what they call a high quality problem to have.
Well, it is a nice problem to have, yes. But it's nonetheless a problem.
Yeah, and actually, and to explain this a bit more, so Berkshire Hathaway is a conglomerate. It's neither a fund nor an investment trust. It's a company itself. You buy shares in it. But it'll buy the shares of listed companies for sure, but it'll also buy part or the whole of other businesses. And you're right about the how small his universe actually is. In the listed companies he can buy, so the shares of listed companies he can buy, there's about 100 globally that are big enough to be able for him to be able to invest and not completely swamp the entire company with that investment. And with that little wriggle room, it's no surprise that performance isn't sort of, you know, high octane.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think he said, you know, if you gave me £1 million, then, you know, I'm quite sure I could do, you know, 50% a year, which, yeah. You know, is pretty punchy thing to say, actually. I think many of us would be very, very happy with that kind of performance. But the point is a real point that if you have a relatively small amount of money and you have a massive universe of investment opportunities, and you're as good an investor as Warren Buffett is, you can find the high growth opportunities. You can't if you've got $700 billion to invest.
But it's fair to say, isn't it, that the world today is very different from how it was at the start of his career. The market is far better researched now for the stock picker, for the guy looking for underappreciated parts of the market. That's simply harder to do these days, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, if you look at Buffett's success over the years, it has been by identifying, you know, undervaluation. So he's essentially always looking to buy a dollar's worth of assets, you know, for 50 cents in the market. So he's just looking for where the value is underappreciated by the market. And it's true that, yes, the market is better researched, but it's also the structure of the market has changed in recent years. We've had the massive growth of private equity. So this is money which has come into the market and invests to a large degree using borrowed money. So they are able to pay a higher price and still get a decent return because they're using money which they've borrowed at generally pretty low interest rates. Now, Buffett doesn't do that. Buffett has a much sort of more cautious approach. He just uses his own money. And therefore, it's very difficult for him to compete with the prices that private equity are paying. Now, maybe private equity is overpaying, but the effect has been to push up the prices of all assets. And so now he looks out there and he simply can't find these, you know, dollar of assets for 50 cents situations anymore.
And that model you talk about, where you're gearing essentially to invest, that works quite nicely when markets as a whole are rising, as they have in the last 10 years. And the environment is probably something we should mention here. Since the financial crisis, lots of central bank money has flooded markets. It's lifted all boats. That simply makes it harder to dodge the basket cases, to really apply that sort of active mindset that makes you and helps you beat the market.
Yes, it does. The skill of the value investor is not really tested in that kind of market. As you say, all boats rise on the tide. So really, the edge which a skilled investor like Buffett possesses is less valuable than in more normal circumstances.
Now, I introduced this section by asking whether Buffett is still relevant. Again, that was a bit of a cheeky question. He clearly is. But as we've mentioned, he is an advocate of passive investing. That's what he would suggest the ordinary person do for themselves. We know that he has lots of fans. He has all, you know, the quotes are endless, really, from him about how to invest. What do you think the value of someone like Buffett and his wisdom is for just the ordinary investors?
Well, I think we'll see the value of Buffett when the market turns down. You know, I mean, as you say, it's when everything's going up, you know, everyone's Warren Buffett. But, you know, when the market crashes, or not crashes, even if it just sort of, you know, falls a bit and the opportunities start to arrive, it's at that moment that the temperamental and psychological strength of someone like Buffett really comes to the fore. Because what he's so brilliant at is not being fazed by what's going on in the market. So, you know, in the height of the financial crisis, investing in Goldman Sachs, and you know, all through the sort of the last 50 years, you know, at the moments of supreme crisis, he just steps in and he just hoovers up assets because, you know, he's a very courageous investor.
Yeah, actually, that's a really important point. I've spoken to fund managers who buy Berkshire Hathaway shares, and they buy it as a sort of downside protection because the huge cash pile, I think it's $100 billion they have just sat in the Berkshire Hathaway account. When markets fall, they can just get more of these stocks, which they love and they've held for decades and decades. They can buy them for cheaper. Other people recognise that, buy the Berkshire Hathaway shares. It's a ballast against market falls.
Yes. And the other thing, the point that you know, is probably worth making about, you know, is Buffett relevant? He is relevant because, you know, the truths that he speaks about investment are perennial truths. They're not, you know, they're not wiped away by the fact that we've had a very unusual market for the last 10 years. You know, markets do revert to the mean, to the average. And, you know, we will see those circumstances again, and you know, and the Buffett approach will work again.
And yeah, that's exactly right. And just finally, I will say, I don't want this to sound like some sort of swan song or obituary for Warren Buffett. 88 years old, his partner Charlie Munger is 95 years old.
Yep.
Apparently, Buffett is in sprightly good health.
So, yeah, and as sharp as a tack, you know, on the evidence of that interview, and he still says he describes it as a sort of perpetual holiday. You know, he loves doing what he does. So, you know, I mean, 88 is just a number, isn't it?
It is indeed. Okay, well, Tom, that's all we have time for now. Thanks for joining me. Thank you. Japan enters a new era today. We're recording on Wednesday, with Emperor Akihito completing the abdication ceremony that means both a new emperor and a new era, the Reiwa era in Japan. It seems then a good time to assess the country and in particular to gauge its progress as it attempts to overcome long-standing challenges to its social and its economic development, challenges that other developed societies face, including us. Tom Stevenson is back with me to discuss it. Tom, Japan is a country that you know well. In fact, I believe that you spent time there at the start of the era that's just ended.
Yeah, that's right, Ed. I lived in Japan in 1987-88, so actually just before Emperor Akihito's reign began, which was in 1989. So that was the beginning of what they called the Heisei era. Each emperor's reign has a name, an era name. Heisei is the one that's just come to an end, and Reiwa, as you say, is the new era, which begins with the ascension of Crown Prince Naruhito to become the next emperor. But yeah, 1989 was a totally different world in Japan. So the Japan that I went to as a young English teacher back then was seen as the future. You know, it was the era of Japan as number one. You know, this was a model of paternalistic capitalism, which was taking over the world and was, you know, destroying the American competition. And, you know, we really thought that this was the future. We extrapolated into the future, you know, which was going to be Japanese. And of course, history showed that it wasn't quite that way.
It's good. I was reading what you wrote about Japan this week, and it really reminded me of I mean, I was a lot younger, so I was basically a child at that point. But even I can remember this sense that Japan was incredibly wealthy, that it was, that all the big money, you would see this in films and things like that, that there was, if you ever wanted to connote sort of mind-bending huge wealth, it would come from Japan, basically.
Yeah, there were these wonderful sort of statistics were bandied around about Japan in the late 1980s, like, you know, the value of land in Tokyo was more than the value of the whole of the United States. The value of the land on which the Imperial Palace stood in the middle of Tokyo was worth more than the whole of California. So, yeah. You know, these are sort of it was a mind-boggling boom in both the stock market boom, but also a real estate boom.
Well, in fact, I was going to say bubble, in fact, wasn't it?
Well, it was a bubble because, of course, it burst shortly after that. And that, of course, is why, you know, people, investors looking at, you know, the prospects for this new era will be hoping desperately that it's a great deal better than the previous era, because, of course, the Heisei era began at the peak of this bubble. The Nikkei index peaked at nearly 40,000. It's currently, you know, 30 years on, it's about 22,000. So, you know, it's just a little over half what it was at its peak. So it's been an astonishing sort of deflation of a bubble. And, you know, that hasn't been replicated anywhere else in the world.
And the bubble burst, and then what set in was lots of negativity about Japan's future prospects. And a lot of those were tied up with demographic challenges. How would you characterise those?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, that is the big headwind that Japan faces, is that it is leading the world in this sort of ageing and shrinking of the population. So if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, the population of Japan was about 40 million. By 2000, it was 130 million, nearly. The expectation is that by the end of this century, the population will have fallen to about 85 million. So that is a massive contraction of the population. And of course, that's resulting in an aging of the population, which in turn is resulting in far too few workers trying to support far too many elderly retired people. That's a big economic challenge for Japan.
And normally faced with the challenge of an aging workforce and fewer working age people and of low growth, there's a couple of levers that you would normally reach for. Immigration might be one of them. You'd want to encourage lots and lots of savings. Japan's had cultural problems getting those things off the ground.
Yes, I mean, you know, there is an inbuilt resistance to outside forces. I mean, that was evident in the 19th century. You know, the Americans had to literally, you know, come in gunships to open up Japan in the 1860s.
It's an island nation in every sense.
Yes, it is. It's an introspective nation. It's suspicious of the outside world. And so it hasn't welcomed immigration, which of course would be one possible solution to its demographic challenges. But there are other cultural issues as well. You know, there are very relatively few women in the workforce in Japan. So there are, as you say, there are levers which it hasn't been pulling, and it's going to have to pull if it's going to navigate this demographic headwind.
It's been trying, though, hasn't it? And Abenomics has been with us for a while. We've spoken about it before as well. How would you judge the progress being made in overcoming those headwinds?
Well, I think, you know, it is possible to paint a pretty negative picture about the prospects for Japan. It's also possible to paint, you know, an improving picture. And you mentioned Abenomics. Shinzo Abe has been prime minister since 2012, and I think he has enacted a number of, you know, really positive economic and social reforms. You know, Japan is a more outward-looking country than it was, and I think that the new emperor will be supportive of that process. He himself was educated here in England at Oxford University. He's a sort of outward-looking international character. So, you know, I think that the Japanese economy is overcoming many of its problems. It seems to have defeated the sort of crippling deflation which affected the country for so many years. Its jobs market is actually very robust. There are more people in work than there have been for decades. Unemployment is at its lowest since the 1970s. Wages are rising. Consumer confidence is rising. So it does appear to be moving out of this period of stagnation.
But all these things, I think, have meant that Japan as an investment market has always been viewed a little sceptically by investors here in the UK. They've tended to underweight Japan. Is that always likely to be the case? I mean, what is the case for buying Japan now?
Well, I think a lot of investors had their fingers burnt in Japan. You know, I mean, if you've invested in Japan really at any point over the last 30 years, then you would have been, you know, lucky to have made money. You know, the consequence of that has been that Japan has moved from being one of the, you know, the most overvalued stock market in the world. I mean, back in 1989, NTT, which is the national telecoms company in Japan, was valued at 100 times earnings. Today, if you look at the Japanese market, it's actually cheaper than Europe or the UK, and certainly cheaper than the US. So it's a pretty attractive valuation now, the Japanese market. And I think, you know, ultimately there is a price for everything. So there are headwinds, there are demographic challenges, but the market is cheap. And, you know, Japan still has a lot going for it economically. You know, it is still you know, a pretty innovative country. It's a leader in, you know, some high-tech industries, automation, robotics, that kind of thing. So, you know, lots of, you know it's not the complete leader in cars and electronics that it was 25, 30 years ago, but it is still the third biggest economy in the world.
And a lot of its biggest companies are outward facing, not particularly facing the Japanese economy that does face these headwinds.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an international economy. And of course, that's one of its challenges at the moment, because it is, you know, exposed to global trade. And, you know, well, that's one of the reasons why in the last year or so there's been a lot of money coming out of Japan, because people have looked at the China-US trade tension situation and realised that the collateral damage for that would actually, you know, be felt in Japan.
OK. Well, Tom, at the end of the one era and the start of another, thank you for joining me. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.